I'm Cassata Bowman. Today, my guest is Chef Kenneth Fong. He joins us from Copenhagen, where he's currently head chef at Noma. I'll open our conversation by asking you to reach into your memory. Here, Have You Eaten Yet? Is focused more on the greeting. It's a check-in of sorts. We're two minds about to take a trip into your life. So this is an opening for us to connect through food. This can be a meal from any time in your life. The hope is whatever meal you choose to talk about is meaningful, that it brings up a memory or emotion. One of the beautiful parts of a meal happens long after the actual event. Those memories can be powerful, and we like to honor and embrace that concept here. Chef Fong.
Thank you for having me, first and foremost. I think I have been very privileged to have had a lot of incredible meals, many that I remember, many that have, you know, been very impactful throughout my life. But I guess we will go to, like, perhaps the most recent one in memory and something that I keep going back to, which is a meal that I've had actually in Japan just over the course of doing the pop-up in Kyoto. And it was actually a meal that I didn't really anticipate would, like, have such a hold on me. But it was a meal at Sazenka in Tokyo. So it's a three-star restaurant that focuses a lot on Chinese cuisine. And I'm Chinese Singaporean, and that was how I grew up. And much like a lot of my peers and my peer group in, you know, the Asian community, when we become chefs, we are, it's not uncommon to, you know, set that aside and pursue a lot more in terms of contemporary French classical technique. And that is kind of how we were trained and kind of what we were doing when we were training to be chefs. And lately, especially, you know, moving to Copenhagen, where there isn't that much of Chinese food, I find myself actually doing a lot of deep dives into Cantonese cuisine and trying to explore my roots and a lot of the foods that I've grown up with. And going to that restaurant, it was on so many levels, it was transcendent. The service was incredible, and the food that they were putting out was it was a mixture of Japanese shokunin kind of culture, the way that the respectful nature of how they approach ingredients and the way that they, you know, they were so careful and so deliberate about every single thing that they were doing. But for me, it felt almost like they were cooking especially for me. It was a lot of there was a lot of techniques and a lot of ingredients that was kind of a throwback to my childhood. But tasting it at that point in time and eating those dishes at that point in time was just like mind-blowing in so many different ways. I never knew Chinese cuisine could be that elaborate. I never knew Chinese cuisine could be, you know, sculpted into that that manner. And it was something that was incredibly mind-blowing and that I still talk about to this day. And I firmly believe that like Chinese cuisine is the next frontier in terms of what's next. And because you see that a lot in terms of Japanese cuisine as well, and in terms of what sushi is and sushi as, that kind of sits up on the top of that pedestal. And that's where everybody wants to go to have your three-star sushi meals. And in terms of Chinese cuisine, it's kind of been, you know, relinquished to be takeout food. and something that's a lot more like budget friendly and cheap. But I firmly believe that, you know, to come when there's a little bit more emphasis in terms of regionality, in terms of like the different types of Chinese cuisine, it's definitely the future. And it was a very clear reminder for me in terms of my roots and my upbringing. That, you know, that's something really exciting. And even to this day, I talk to my friends and my family about it all the time, about this one particular meal that I had in Japan. And they were like, "You had Chinese food in Japan?" And I'm like, "Yes, I did." And it was amazing. And it was actually really, really cool. Something that I talk about.
Going back to that meal, was there one dish or one flavor profile that just really captured your attention? You said transcendent. So I'm just curious, like, was there one dish that stood out that you were like, wow?
For sure. I mean, there were so many, to be very honest. One of the favorites that we've had, you know, in terms of staff meal all the time is Mapo Tofu, right? And something that you eat constantly. There's everyone that has a different version of it. And the way that they offered this version of their Mapo Tofu is something that you would never expect in a restaurant. So you're like three quarters of the way into the meal. You know, you've had perhaps, you know, blowfish tails prepared in the style of like in a Sichuan style, buried in chilies. And then you're digging into like an incredibly rich broth with some dumplings, nice vegetables. And then they come to you like, how are you feeling? Are you still a little bit hungry? And of course you are. You know, when would you not be? And they'd be like, oh, yeah, the chef wants to prepare a little something for you, you know, a little version of Mapo Tofu. So he's wondering if you would be okay with that. And like, yes, absolutely. And then, you know, two dishes down, he comes with a perfectly like a round bowl of like rice. But it's like a really, really small quantity, nothing that, you know, you would be like stuffed with. And it scoops it out of a perfect donabe that's like cooked perfectly. And then on that, just one spoonful of this perfect Mapo Tofu that's like cooked with the freshest like Sancho peppers instead of like Sichuan peppers. So it has a little bit more of this citrusy zing instead of this kind of like dull mala flavor that you would come to expect from regular dried Sichuan peppercorns. And there were a whole bunch of different things in there that was like a different interpretation of how a Japanese person or a Japanese master would approach that dish. Instead of having, you know, like some of the pickled cabbage stems, they made their own house-made pickles that were a lot fresher, a lot more textural in terms of nature, in terms of its texture, of course. And then the pork that they used was just on a completely different level. It was just, if you could take every single element of that dish and elevate it to another level, they did exactly that. And then you just left there just completely silent. We were just looking around the table. There was four of us and we were like, this is ridiculous. How is this even possible? And to even bring it back full circle. So we invited him to come to Kyoto to eat because he was very kind to have us. And we were like, Kawada-san, you need to come and see what we're doing. You know, we really want to show you what we're doing. And he comes with his team and he brings for us for family meal, perfectly vacuum packed portions of Mapo Tofu that we could share with the rest of the team. And it was like, this is incredible. There's nothing that's going to top this in terms of like staff meal gifts. You know, in the US, people bring like beers for when they come to restaurants. I never in my life would anticipate someone bringing like bags of Mapo Tofu. That was amazing. So that was really fun.
That was an incredible story. Thank you for sharing.
Yeah, of course.
Well, let's dive into Noma, your present moment. You are embarking on a transitional period as Noma 3.0 rolls out in 2025 and the restaurant transforms into a test kitchen. And I'm just going to go by what I've read. So what I've read is your team will continue to travel and host pop-ups. Seasonal menus and service will also still be hosted in Copenhagen at times. When I read about the concept, the sentence that stood out to me was, quote, serving guests will still be a part of who we are, but being a restaurant will no longer define us. As head chef, how will your day-to-day look once Noma 3.0 rolls out?
Yeah, that's a great question. And to be 100% honest with you, I don't necessarily know what that would be like. This transition for us is equal parts, I would say actually more nerve-wracking than it is exciting at this point in time. We don't necessarily know what it would look like in terms of the future. But I guess the best way to kind of answer it is to talk a little bit about how we got there in the first place and like, what was the original intention behind making this transition? And personally, for me and also for the restaurant, we kind of chose to move away from the traditional model of what Noma used to be purely because we realized that it was not sustainable. And I'm sure you being, you know, in the industry for a while as well, you understand, you know, there's a certain part of the industry that requires a lot of inputs in terms of labor, hours, work, resources, and it's very different from a lot of other industries. And specifically, the term burnout for us is one that is less so a choice, but more so of an inevitability, so to speak. It's always kind of looming in the background. And for us, we realized, especially after the whole going through COVID and what it was, that we loved this industry. We really love what we do. We love to cook and we love to serve guests. That's at the very base level of what we do. And we want to do this for a long time. This isn't something that, you know, we're going to get to 45 and then my legs are given out. I'm going to have to switch to being a teacher or being something else. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but, you know, our original intention is to remain in the kitchen and to serve guests. And also this idea of like being able to provide for our team and being able to, you know, give them something in which they could just be very, and what's the word here I'm looking for, to be kind of in the medium, in so to speak, for them to be able to, you know, afford a house in the suburbs and to be able to have, you know, two kids, a dog, and a white picket fence. And it's a rarity in our industry that you're able to do something like that. And that requires a little bit of change. And the model that we've kind of been working with so far is one that is based off of an old model of extraction. And this comes from, you know, like the industrial times where you kind of see every individual and you see everyone who kind of works for you as a fungible resource, so to speak. And you would see them as a commodity, something that you could get some sort of value from. And then when you're done, you replace them with another commodity, another resource. And that doesn't work for our industry. It's something that is a little bit backward. And we're trying to look towards inverting that model and to try to look at the inherent dormant ability within each people. And everyone that comes to work for us, we see it as there's something that we can pull out from you in terms of to make you a better version of yourself, so to speak. And this transition, basically, we still, like, just like what you said, we still want to be a restaurant in that sense, but we want to move away from the hustle and bustle and the grind of working, you know, 350 days a year to something that is a little bit more like maybe 90 days a year, who knows? And we want to dedicate the rest of our time to kind of exploring different sources of, you know, work. And what can we do? What can we do with the creativity that we have in the restaurant? And how can we channel it? And how can we put it into a different medium? You know, it could be, you know, creating CPG products through Noma projects. It could be working with different media companies to produce something, basically to relook at the revenue model of what a restaurant would be. Because for most restaurants, you're limited by the number of covers that you can do in a night. And it's not necessarily scalable. If anything, it's one-to-one. The more covers you have to do, the more you need to add on in terms of labor and in terms of costs. But if you look at, you know, which is what we always do, is to look at some of the bigger tech companies and what is the product that they're creating and why is it that they have infinite scalability in terms of what they're doing? What can we take away from that? And I feel like that is our challenge for the future in terms of really relooking at the model of how we work. And it's unnerving in a sense because no one has kind of done it before. But we also feel that the work we're going to do is so important because we're setting an example for what's to come. And if we're able to pull it off, maybe we can help other companies, other restaurants try to get to that level too in a way that, you know, is different from what it is now, which is a very cyclical nature, unfortunately. I don't know if that answers your question at all.
Absolutely. And now I have follow-up. Now I really need to dive into that mind of yours because this is fascinating. You are looking at tech, you are looking at the restaurant industry, you are looking at what is scalable, you are looking at quite literally changing our industry in a way that we all will benefit ultimately from. I could go down a million different paths here. So let's start with you are in the unknown. And that is, as you say, at times unnerving. So all of us, when we're navigating life on this planet, we go through times where we're in the unknown and it is unnerving. How do you navigate through those emotions?
There's, of course, kind of two routes that you go to, and unnerving in terms of professionally is perhaps one that's a little bit easier to navigate, and then unnerving in terms of a personal thing, that's a completely different matter. But I'll share with you there are similarities that I go through in terms of both, which is, you know, I have a group of individuals that I normally like to speak to in terms of like these are a group of people that I trust, and these are the people that I kind of seek validation from, and these are the people that I know would never set me on the wrong path. Or so in terms of professionally, you know, of course, when you come up with an idea like what I just mentioned to you, some people and most people are going to be like, you're crazy. It's not going to work. You're sitting on top of, you know, a dynasty that you've created, an institution that you've created, or, you know, Renee has created for 20 years. And it seems like you don't understand what's going on. There's a lot of uncertainty. It's a lot of risk, not a lot of reward. You know, we stay away from those people. Instead, we talk to a little bit more individuals who are like, whoa, that sounds crazy. Let me show you a little bit of case studies. You should speak to this guy. And we have a group of these people that we talk to. And one of the lessons that I learned really early on when I first took over, you know, Renee would always be like, if you don't have the solution, pick up the phone and call someone. There are very few people that would refuse a phone call from the head chef of Venoma, you know, and he would be like, pick up the phone, call someone and ask them. And I think at this point in time with, you know, all the work that we've done and all the relationships that we've built, we have a good community of individuals that we trust, a good community of people that we also admire and people that we learn from all the time, people that we feel are, you know, thought leaders, not just in our industry, but in the world at large. I think there is a commonality in terms of good leadership, good management that goes beyond just the restaurant industry. And you can see that everywhere. And I think we're lucky enough to be able to call on them. And then personally, of course, you know, I rely on a lot. My wife, she plays a huge role in my life. As an individual and as chefs, I think we are a very hard-headed group of people. And when we set our minds on something, it's sometimes difficult to, you know, dissuade you otherwise. But sometimes you could be going down a path that is not necessarily beneficial for you or the people around you. And what I've always done is to, you know, allow the people closest to me to disagree with me. And I actually also encourage them. And I tell my wife all the time, you know, if you think that I'm doing something wrong, you need to tell me. And I say this to my management team as well. And I'm like, I'm by no means perfect. I make horrible decisions sometimes, and you need to tell me, you know, because we are a group of people that sometimes self-validate, and it's not the best in terms of trying to spot mistakes or trying to course correct. So sometimes you need people that you trust and people that, you know, you can rely on to pat you on the back and be like, hey, I don't think this is the right course to go down. I think there's something else here that we should explore. And personally, that has always been a very strong guiding principle for me. And I have a group of people that I, you know, I quite literally trust in my life. And if they tell me that they feel something is amiss, I generally will listen. And that helps a lot.
What's the best piece of advice that you've ever been given?
I guess the one most recently that I've been kind of harping on and trying to integrate into my life is something that Renee actually spoke to me about, you know, maybe 2 years ago. And it was this idea about like, you need to focus on yourself, or you need to put yourself first. And I know it sounds really silly, but for chefs, we tend to get absorbed in the work that we do, to the point where, like I mentioned to you, we eat. Life is work and work is life, essentially. And we were going through, I think, a period of like just intense change in terms of like switching structures of service and everything. And I think we were having a conversation about, you know, training and like riding bikes and whatnot. And he's like, so how are you doing? You know, how are you getting on with the, you know, riding outside? And I was like, oh, I didn't really have the time to do so. And he was like, Chef, you should make the time to do it, you know? And I was like, yeah, but I'm so busy with this and that. And he was like, you need to put yourself first. You need to prioritize what it is that is good for you as well, because what is good for you will be good for the company in the long run of things. And I didn't really think too much of it. You know, I brushed it off at that point in time and carried on with what I needed to do. And then several kind of months later, we kind of followed up again. And it got to a point where he was like, no, you need to figure this out. And it got to a place where he actually made me schedule my time away from the restaurant. He was like, no, you don't come in to work at this time. Come in later, leave earlier, figure out what it is that you need to do. And I thought it was such a silly exercise at that point in time. It's like, I'm trying to work. I'm trying to do better for the restaurant. And when you're stuck in that cycle, you tend to fail to see that cooking, especially, or in most industries, I would say, it benefits from you having all your ducks in a row, mentally as well, physically as well. And when you're able to kind of have all that dialed in, you work better. And I didn't see it until much later. And, you know, even personally, I had to go through some, you know, periods of time where I struggled a little bit in terms of anxiety and in terms of, you know, how my mental state was. And this advice was also good in terms of like making me focus a little bit more on my mental well-being and, you know, seeking help for these kinds of things. And going to a therapist and talking to my therapist about certain things and focusing on a lot of different aspects outside just work. And like a year down the road, or even just 6 months down the road, suddenly, you know, things were happening in terms of my productivity and in terms of my ability to solve problems a little bit better and a little bit more in terms of the systems that I was able to bring to work that, you know, made things a little bit better. And it's ironic to kind of think about it, but because I've come, a lot of my best work has been done when I was not focusing on working. It's actually quite strange. And I never would have actually been able to achieve a lot of what that was if I wasn't pushed out of my current schedule or my current routine of just working nonstop, you know. And I think it's important that you have someone like that to be able to be like, you need to leave. You need to go and do something that is not work, because it's better for you and it's better for the company and it's better for me in the long run, you know. And I think that was probably one of the best advice that I received in a long time that I'm still trying to integrate into my life.
Let's go back in time to your early days at Noma. You arrived later in your career with over a decade of experience. I'd love for you to take us through what a typical day looked like for you back then.
That's a fun question. I think the restaurant was very, very different back then. And when I first made the decision to come to Noma, it was a decision to come on as an intern. So it was a very different position from what I was used to. And like you mentioned, I came from a good amount of experience back there from having run my own restaurant to being an intern. And I knew it would be difficult and I knew it would be hard and I knew there would be some changes. So I was quite prepared for that mentally. But when nothing would have been able to prepare me for my first day when I stepped in, and it was just an intensity like nothing I've never imagined. I mean it in the best way. I don't mean it in a negative way. But everyone was running, like sprinting the moment they were in the door. Everyone was like pushing and everyone was so driven to get to, you know, a specific direction, which is to be set up for the day. And it was palpable, the energy that you could feel from the time you stepped into the door. It was so contagious. And it was the first time I remember thinking to myself that I was like, whoa. Most people used to say like, oh yeah, all these things and these feelings that you have, they're not necessarily tangible. But over here, it was very tangible. You could feel it. It was thick in the air. It was electric. The atmosphere was like crazy. And then service started, and that was on another level. And you could see people were just like so honed in and so focused on what they were doing. But at the same time, there was like an element of fun, an element of chaos, organized chaos, that you don't see in a lot of restaurants, because where I come from, which is white tablecloth, three stars, and everything, it's all about silence, precision, calmness. And over here it was the opposite, you know. And from an outside view, on an outside perspective, sometimes you can misunderstand the chaos for being messiness, but it's probably one of the most well-run operations, in the sense where you have, it's like watching a black and white movie on fast forward on mute. Everything is just moving so quickly, so seamlessly, but it's busy. It looks busy. It looks fast, you know? And that really, like, after the first day, I was hooked, essentially. I was like, this is incredible. I need more. I need to come back for more. I need to do more.
And looking back at your first few months at Noma, are there any hurdles and or highlights that really stand out to you?
It was difficult to get used to the tempo that I just told you. It's like, it required a lot of preparation in terms of mental preparation as well. And most people don't understand this. And when, you know, when I tell them, oh, I would meditate before going to work, I would visualize my day, I would be like, why would you need to do that? And when I explain to them what I do, they're like, okay, that makes a little bit more sense. But like having to do a lot of the mental preparation that is required of you to be successful in your job, that was difficult for me to get used to. But at the same time, it provided a lot of satisfaction when you got it right. And this intensity, when at the end of the week, when you're done and you greet the guests and you say goodbye to them, or you say you thank them for coming, and you know they tell you this has been the best experience that they've ever been through, or it's like this has been amazing, and they just go on and telling you about all the little things that they loved about, you know, their experience here. And it was like, it was, there's a warm feeling that you it's difficult to engineer. And it's a sense of satisfaction and gratitude that is hard to come by. And even it never gets old. Even here I am 6 years into doing pretty much what I've been doing, leading the team and working services. I never tire of that feeling. And it's also a responsibility that I remind myself and I remind my team. It's like, you are in direct control of, you're basically the architect of anyone who comes in here, that for those 2-3 hours of your lives, you have an opportunity, you have an ability to make a change. You have an ability to remove them from the stressors of whatever that it is you're feeling, create a bubble, spin the spell around them, tell them a story, and for that 3 hours, just completely fill them with joy and hospitality that they're unable to kind of get from anywhere else. And then when they leave enriched, restored, right? Which is the original definition of a restaurant in the first place. And for me, that is like always been a high in terms of working in here and working in this place as well. But I think also when I took over as the head chef, I think that kind of satisfaction has also moved into seeing a lot of my team members grow into new positions and to step up and to move into new roles and to see them grow into like next level professionals. Or even when they move on, it's just a sense of pride that I think you only understand as when you take on a role of a mentor. And that has been very, very fulfilling as well.
How do you stay true to yourself while navigating the ups and downs of life?
I'm fairly level-headed in terms of my temperament and in terms of, you know, my outlook on life. I understand. I'm fairly content in most areas of my life. And I've always been quite grounded by those values and the way that I would like to approach my work. But also having these group of individuals around me, they play a really key role in helping me stay grounded and staying rooted to my values, you know. And when I first took over as a head chef here in Noma, and I had a period of time where, you know, I would always meet with the sous chefs who had been here for the longest time, and I would be like, do you have any advice for me, and do you have, you know, can you help me with something, is there something I should know, because I'm stepping into this position and I feel a lot of pressure. And the commonality of the advice that they've given to me, it was that don't lose yourself in the process. And I never understood what they meant by it until, you know, much later in my time. And I guess what they were trying to allude to was this idea that, you know, you were chosen to lead because of your specific personality and the way what you bring to the team. And it there isn't this like model or this standard one size fits all for what determines whether you're a good head chef or not, or a good leader or a good mentor, or even a good cook for that matter. And I took that to heart in terms of the way that I try to stay true to myself, is to understand the original intention, my original intention of being here in the first place. And I say that to a lot of people, which is to be a good human being. You know, I think it is the genesis of our industry. And that's why you're here, because you want to take care of people. And in order to take care of people, whether it is in the dining room or whether it is your employees or whether it is, you know, people that work for you, if you're a good human being, it ticks all the boxes. You're always out for, you know, you're looking out for their welfare, and you're always trying to make sure that, you know, they become the best versions of themselves, just like the leaders that came before me. And that has always been, I think, a very big grounding principle for me. Be a good human being. If you are, you're set, you know.
What would you tell your younger self? Maybe it's advice, a thought, or a feeling.
To kind of embrace vulnerability a little bit more. And growing up in an Asian household, and even growing up in a chef, as a chef, especially, you know, in New York and whatever that is, or in general around the world, you tend to embrace this stoic nature of being a chef, and this idea that, you know, you need to kind of suffer in silence, and this idea that you need to keep all your hardships inside and bottle them up. And you know, not show any signs of weakness, because then you would be taken advantage of. And it's only later on in life, even now, that I start to understand that vulnerability isn't a weakness, and it's actually a strength. And it allows you to connect much better with the individuals that you work with. And it's something that I make an active decision every day to be a little bit more vulnerable with the people around me. And I feel like if I could go back in time and, you know, tell myself, like, hey, you know, Don't be so afraid of being vulnerable. Don't be so afraid of you know, letting people in, because it's gonna get better. You know, it's going to be okay. And I didn't realize that until much later down the road. And even now, I think I suffer with the repercussions of not having a full emotional vocabulary as much as I want to. And but you live and you learn, just like everything.
Reflecting on your career, is there one service that sticks out that brought you a deep sense of joy?
I think I've been very fortunate to have had many services like that. And it isn't necessarily services where, you know, you cook for a particular individual or a high profile chef or a high profile guest, even though that does contribute to, you know, adding a little bit of that focus to the service. But I think I'll just like kind of talk a little bit more about, you know, the themes of these services that have always left me with a sense of awe and wonder and gratitude. And I think there was a service like that in Kyoto where whenever we do a pop-up, or whenever we take the entire team and uproot them and plant them somewhere else, there's a whole number of issues that you kind of have to deal with, most of them logistical, and just working in a foreign environment with a new menu, new tools, new setup, new everything. So it's like it's trying to solve a Rubik's Cube that keeps fighting back. It's difficult. But for me, when we get it, when everything works and everything that you've kind of planned and everything that you have try to teach your teams and their teams teach each other, and then when you see things kind of click into place, there's a moment and you can sense it in service where everything is just like working the way it should. And I don't mean this in like you could hear a pin drop. It's actually crazy, like chaotic, like I mentioned before. But when these services come, there's like an energy that just flows through the kitchen and into the dining room. It's like, oh, now we're cooking. And it's amazing to see, especially from my perspective, where you're kind of just overlooking the kitchen and trying to jump around. And then suddenly you see that things are flowing the way that it should. And it's one of the most satisfying feelings ever, especially when you've done a lot of work before. and everything snaps into place. It's, ooh, yeah.
What's one trip that you've been on that has positively impacted your life? This could be an actual trip, or maybe it's a good memory, like a trip down memory lane, or it could be a psychedelic trip.
It was my first time actually going to Japan when we went the last time, which is a shock for most people. I know they're like, what? It's your first time going to Japan and you're a chef. What's going on? You know? But I didn't understand, or I didn't think it would make that huge of an impact on me until I went. And I don't just mean in terms of food, but when you move to a country, especially a country like Japan, for an extended period of time, you know, 3 months, 6 months, whatever that it is, or years. And Japan has a really unique culture that is so removed from what us Westerners would kind of see as norm. But they're also so deliberate in everything that they do. The society is kind of built on like this idea that everything that you do should be with intent, with purpose. You should never go through life without having a sort of deliberate nature towards what you're doing. And it extends to the moment you wake up to the moment you go to bed, and everything in between, your work, walking to, you know, the bus. And therefore you have all these ideologies around like being excellent craftsmen. But beyond that, even when I first moved there, I was like a little bit, I was kind of filled with a lot of anxiety, because for me, I'm kind of like an introvert. I don't really go out that much, and I don't necessarily like to put myself in awkward social situations. And personally for me, moving to Japan was very difficult. I remember the first time going to a grocery store, and I had my phone in my hand, and I was going up to the shelves, and they have a completely different way of organizing the grocery stores and a different, completely different line of products that you would be used to back home. And, you know, trying to translate everything, because I didn't want to look like the tourist. I didn't want to look like the foreigner, you know, even though you're so clearly the foreigner, even though you're so clearly the tourist. But I had this anxiety around just like social anxiety about like speaking to someone, because obviously you don't know the language that well. And so the first time, I remember I went to, when I first got into Kyoto, I went to pick up, you know, shampoo, toothpaste, and toilet paper, three things. It took me about an hour to navigate the shelves to get these things solely because I was afraid to ask, you know. And after a couple of weeks there, I started to ease into things, and I'd be like, you know what, just do it, just try, just like get out there, just be uncomfortable. And you do that so much in terms of your work. Why is it so difficult for you in, you know, life? And when I decided to do that, it was like you could see doors just open everywhere, and people were so welcoming. I would walk down the street, and this Japanese lady invited me into her home. I had no idea who she was. I was literally walking down as a stranger, and she's like, hey, you, come and look at my art, you know, on the walls of her house. You know, my son drew this. And the policy, they have like almost an open door policy there. It was in a really quaint street in Kyoto, an old town. And then like, here, come in and look at my art. It was beautiful. It was amazing. And then you meet different people who are like, you think you know things about food, and you think you know things about coffee, and they take it on a completely another level. They have an insane amount of knowledge that's dedicated to one product, and the discipline that they live your life is just wild. But the beauty of the society is just, it's amazing. And even cycling around Kyoto, when we took time to just cycle outside the neighborhoods, and it's not an exaggeration to say it's literally out of a postcard. And, you know, everyone is clamored on the Philosopher's Path during cherry blossom season to look at cherry blossoms. And we took, you know, me and Thomas, one of my colleagues, we took like a bike ride to climb a mountain. And on the mountainside, it was literally pink and purple, and there was not a soul in sight. It was so beautiful. And everything about that just makes you gain a sense of appreciation for your time and place where you are now. It gives you an appreciation and a gratitude for, you know, we have it really, really good. But there's always something to learn from someone. There's always something to learn from a different culture. And a culture like Japan, which has so much to offer if you just, you know, like what I said, you're a little bit vulnerable. You allow people to come into your lives. And even working with ingredients, on the menu, there were things that we had to learn, things that we had to, there was no like English names for ingredients that you would never find outside of Japan, because they would never be imported out of Japan. And that was wild. It was like you're a child again. You're learning, you know, what a potato is. You're learning what a carrot is. And that sense of, you know, bewilderment and the sense of wonder and awe, it just hits you again. And it was amazing to kind of be like that kid in a candy store and to be like, oh, what does this taste like? What is this? What is that? Everything was so amazing. And it's the culmination of everything that I've just kind of described that I think made that trip so special. And to just kind of be immersed in such a culture that is so respectful to, you know, your nature, your surroundings, and to each other is something that you would never really find in our Western society. So that was certainly life-changing for me.
What's next for you? What are you excited for in the months to come? It could be traveling, changing your daily habits, slowing down in life, a work-related project, whatever you are looking forward to.
You'll be surprised how many times I get asked that, especially when we put out the word that NOMA is closing. It's like, oh, what's next for you? What's next for you? Like, what are you going to do? Are you going to open your own restaurant and whatnot? And to be honest, I'm not 100% sure. And I think for the first time in my life, I'm actually okay with that. Growing up, especially working in New York and kind of in this high, strong environment, you're always like pushing yourself to plan what's next and to be two steps ahead every single time. Well, when I'm done with this restaurant, I'm going to work at this other restaurant. I'm going to work here. I'm going to move here. And I don't really have a plan in terms of that. But also, I guess my plan is to stay. And I think the work that we have ahead of us is tremendously important in terms of what it could do to shape the industry. The one thing I really don't want to do is to open a restaurant and fall victim to the cycle of repeating what everyone has done and to, you know, run a restaurant that's based on the operating systems that currently exist today, because I think that would be a tremendous failure in terms of personally for me, especially seeing, you know, what lies in store for you at the end of it. And I feel like we have an opportunity here to make a difference and to make an impact that goes beyond the 83 covers that we serve every single night. And I think that work is really important. And that's also really exciting to kind of retune your mind a little bit. And you've always been kind of solving problems and applying your creativity towards food and what it means in terms of menus, in terms of what it means for a guest, for service. But I have a hypothesis that, you know, the way that we approach things are also applicable towards bigger structural problems or bigger structural issues, whether it be, you know, dealing with the problem of labor, dealing with the problem of, you know, the unsustainable nature of restaurants and how we can apply ourselves to it. I work with some of the most talented people here, and I don't mean that as a brag, but like the chefs that work here and even those that are not chefs are like some of the most intelligent, some of the most talented individuals that I've ever seen. And we take them from all aspects of life, you know, not just in food. Some of them are from, you know, a poli science background. Some of them are from, you know, a tech background, and they all come together to try to create solutions for the restaurant and to run the restaurant as it were, you know, a Fortune 500 company or something. I think sometimes restaurants limit themselves a little bit too much when they think, oh, we're just a restaurant, but you're not. You're not. You can do so much more. You're so much more than you can do to impact not just the guests in your dining room, but, you know, restaurants in the old days used to be watering holes where people gather around and people connect and people talk about important issues and people talk about, you know, social issues. And I think that's also relevant in terms of what we do. So personally, for me, that's a lot of, there's a lot of excitement surrounding that. And I think I've always said, you know, I wanted to kind of make an impact, but in terms of a larger impact in terms of not just in the dining room, but also what we can do for our industry. It's like I said, we love our industry so much. I think there's we just need to kind of find a way to work at it a little bit better. And for me, that is a challenging next step. So I'm in it.
Death is a topic that we often avoid openly discussing in our society. Yet it's something that we all face at some point in life. Personally, having healthy conversations about death produces an awareness about the present moment, an appreciation for life, and helps me live fully. Do you have any thoughts, emotions, or insights about death from your upbringing or lived experience that you'd like to share?
When you grow up in an Asian household, especially a Chinese household, death is not a topic you really talk about because it's a taboo thing. It brings bad luck. Nobody really wants to talk about it. But I guess kind of similarly in what you have said, when lately I contemplate this idea about death or moving on, I'm always filled with the sense of gratefulness. And I know it sounds strange, but lately I've been meditating a lot about the concept of being grateful and being content. And I also mentioned to my wife the other day, you know, because we were planning, you're at an age where you fill in like, you know, wills and fill up life insurances and whatnot. So you think a little bit more about, okay, what's going to happen? You know, is everything going to be okay and things are fine? And I'm not necessarily stressed or anxious about it because on one hand, I'm really grateful for everything that has come my way. I think I've had an amazing life where I've had the opportunity to travel the world, I have the opportunity to eat, and you know, I have a unique set of skills that allow me to connect with people on a very visceral level. This idea of food, this idea of commensality, which connects you to not just people, but cultures. And for me, I think that's a life well lived. And if I were to like kick the bucket, you know, knock on wood tomorrow, I think I would be okay with that. I think it would be fine knowing that I've kind of made a difference in at least one or two individuals and you know, brought my spin on food and what it means to be a chef. But every time I think about something like that, it's always about gratefulness. And it's something I remind myself, you know, you have the opportunity to pursue something that you love, to do something that you love, which it's not granted, you know. You have the opportunity to go to bed at night and wake up, which especially in these times, it's not a given. You know, there are people, you know, who have to worry about a lot more than you do when you start complaining or you start getting upset about orders not coming in on time or not being set up on time. And sometimes it's nice. And I say this to my management team as well. I'm like, guys, you know, sometimes when you think about the bigger problems of the world, everything that we talk about here seems so insignificant and so stupid, you know. Of course, we still have to take things seriously, and we still have to have this emphasis on what is it that we're doing to make it the best ever. But also in the grand scheme of things, it's not the end of the world, you know. There are some, for some people and for some in situations where it is the end of the world, and we are far, far, far removed from what that is. And like I said, I'm extremely grateful for opportunities that have come my way. And it's the first thing that I think about when I wake up and I walk my dog and I'm like, wow, this is amazing. I have an amazing wife and an amazing dog and a house to live in. And it's the thing that I go to bed at night thinking about. I'm like, ooh, this is incredible. And so, yeah, I'm happy to, if tomorrow's the day, I would be like, this is fine. I think I've lived an amazing life.
Have there ever been any signs or synchronicities in your life that guided you in some way? It could be a chance encounter with a stranger, a conversation that led to an opportunity that you could not have arranged even if you tried. There's a wide spectrum here. Nothing is off limits.
I'm a firm believer of, you know, putting things out into the universe and hopefully seeing that something comes back to you. I don't necessarily know if there's any like very obvious signs of synchronicities, but I think when I think back about my last year, as a personal experiment, I decided to take on the sport of triathlon, and I decided to participate in a full Ironman because I had this idea that, you know, chefs have this amount of discipline, and we are these individuals that you're able to push beyond a certain threshold of exhaustion or pain, or you can carry this mental discipline into whatever it is that you're doing. And I wanted to test that hypothesis. So I decided to take on triathlon, and it was an amazing experience in so many ways. And I never knew that doing something like that could teach me a lot about myself as an individual, but also myself as a chef. And I took away so many lessons. And one of the stories that I tell my team, I actually mentioned to my team, and there's no way I could have made this up. You know, I was on the way to a race, and I was in a car with my colleague and another of his friends who was also competing. And he was asking, you know, he looked at me because I was a little green on the gills, and he was like, "You're right." And I'm like, "No, I'm a little bit nervous. You know, I actually don't feel so well. Like, I'm about to throw up." And he was like, "Yeah, I feel so nervous too." And then he said something to me, and he asked, like, "I wonder if you feel like that, you know, when you're about to open for service and you're about to, you know, open for a season." And I'm like, "Actually, yeah, I feel like that all the time." And then he said something to me, which gave me such a strong appreciation for the work that I do. And he was like, "Whoa, you must have the best job in the world." And I'm like, "Huh, I never really thought about it that way." And he was like, "People have to sign up for all these crazy races, and people have to put themselves in such crazy situations for them to have this feeling of butterflies in your stomach, which you feel every day. You must have something that you really, really care about, and you must have something that, you know, is amazing and is so tremendous in whatever that it is that you do." And I always thought that to be, like, so wonderful. And beyond that, it's also, I've learned a lot about dealing with anxiety personally. Like I mentioned to you, it sounds strange that, you know, the head chef of a 3-star restaurant would have some sort of issues with anxiety. But I think it manifests in all different ways and forms. And going through the idea of what it means to compete at that level really taught me about how to, you know, compartmentalize my mind and to try to prepare myself mentally in terms of dealing with the unknown or dealing with what is it that you cannot control. And I mean, it's a whole different story, so I'm not going to bore you with the details, but I think taking on that project last year was something that gave me back something that I could have never planned for. And it became so much more than just a personal experiment in terms of pushing yourself beyond boundaries, but it left me with a lot of stories and a lot of lessons to share with the team as well. And that was kind of cool.
Thank you for sharing your wisdom with us. I believe that the journey is always greater than the destination. It's on the path that we learn, evolve, and encounter lessons that shape us into our best selves. And I always like ending by asking if there's any takeaway that you'd like to leave with listeners that can positively influence their lives. It could be something we just discussed, a lesson you've learned on your journey, or general life advice that you live by.
To play even just an exercise on self-actualization about what it is that you have. And I think if people do that a little bit more often, you would have a group of individuals, a society of individuals that are filled with a lot more content and a little bit more happiness and a little bit more gratefulness, which I think goes a long way in terms of the society that we live in. It makes seemingly larger problems seem quite small, and it makes moments that seem quite fleeting actually quite important. And it's something that I'm learning even till this day, and something that I'm very, very thankful for.
And where or how is the best way for people to connect or get in touch with you?
I think Instagram is always the best way. People send messages there all the time, and I'm usually pretty good at responding. So that's a good way.
Thanks for listening. And if you haven't already, follow Have You Eaten Yet wherever you get your podcasts.